Hello out there in internet land. Once again, it's time for the Dungeons & Dragons podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me this week are Shelley Mazenoble, player-in-chief, and D&D developer Jeremy Crawford.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
This week, we're tackling the upcoming DM's Kit, along with the new Game World role-playing game, and if we have time at the end, we'll also answer a few questions in the mailbag. So sit back, relax, and on with the show. So, first off, let's talk about the DM's Kit. Have you guys had a chance to look at it yet? Or?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And to walk you guys through it, I have a copy of the DM's Kit right here. So I'm going to go over very quickly what we have in it. There are, and actually I just physically opened it, so I guess this is the order in which you'll see it.
If you crack yours.
It smells brand new.
It's because I love the smell of a new game box when you open it up.
The new box smell. So there are two adventures, each of which are 32 pages long, written by Rich Baker. They are meant to sort of one follows the other. There's a Reeves of Harkenwald, and then part one, the Iron Circle, then part two, the Die is Cast. Now, the nice thing is, kind of like with the Red Box, all the maps you need and all the tokens you need are in the box. So there's also a little sheet.
Ooh, that's nice.
This is very. This is our sheet showing off all the other products in the Essentials line. So the starting point. And with the idea with the DM's Kit, like the rest of the Essentials line, it's really meant to be very inclusive. So in this, for the DM's Kit, you get a DM screen. It has the same art as the fourth edition DM screen that came out about 2 years ago, but the tables have been updated. So the DCs, for example, are the new DCs we've published in the Rules Compendium.
Yes.
And I think a few other small things here and there, like, for example, the DCs, I believe, use the hard and moderate notation rather than actually having the numbers. You just look at, and the way they're arranged, those panels are right next to each other, so the DC by level is there, and then right next to it are the DCs for commonly used skills.
The screen also includes some of our new conditions, like removed from play, grabbed is now a condition, and all of the condition definitions are up to date, matching what we have in the Rules Compendium.
Yeah, so if you're currently playing 4th edition and you're just looking for an updated DM screen, this is a great product. You get an updated DM screen and you get all these other pieces. So there's also a bundle, like I mentioned before. There's maps and tokens for the monsters. Unlike the Red Box tokens, where for the monsters there was, just for space reasons really, there'd be one monster on one side and a different monster on the other side. On these tokens, there's the monster's on one side and then it's a bloodied notation on the other side.
Which I happen to love.
Yeah, it's really nifty. So instead of having to use a token or anything to track it, you just
flip
the token
over. You don't have to ask your DM constantly. Which one of these guys is bloody?
The other nice thing, and I've actually been using this in my Keep on the Borderlands campaign, there are also a couple of pit trap tokens, 2x2 pit traps you can use. So just this week in my campaign, the players were invading a kobold lair. They came across a pit trap. It's nice just to punch that out and just drop it on the table.
Of course, my Eladrin ignored the trap entirely by simply teleporting over it.
Yes, but of the three of the other four characters fell into the pit trap. All by rolling 9s on their athletics checks.
My Eladrin had too much panache to fall into that, into that pit.
And then finally, there's the DM's book. It's a 6x9 format book, same format as their other Essentials books. And it basically covers the gist of being a DM. I mean, have you guys had a chance to look at this book yet? Or?
Well, I worked on that book, in fact.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
The book has a lot of the advice that we included a few years ago in the Dungeon Master's Guide. It also includes some of our updated rules material from the Rules Compendium. So in a way, it's sort of a mashup of DM advice, rules that the Dungeon Master needs to run the game, tips on creating encounters, on creating skill challenges, adventures, campaigns, and whatnot.
Yeah, so it's just a handy guide for new DM. And if you're an existing DM, it's just, I think I like the format myself. It's a little bit handier. So it's kind of what I carry around now instead of necessarily DMG, for XP and things like that. I've also found just the box itself. I run a campaign. I used to run a Temple of Mental Evil campaign here at the office. That campaign is on hiatus just because we went so long with people not being available, conventions and everything. We've started a new campaign using the Essentials only as our starting point, Keep on the Borderlands. And I actually use this box along with the contents just to carry everything around for my campaign. So if I draw maps, I just fold them up. There's a cardboard insert in here for the 6x9 DM's book, but I just simply took the insert out and just stack everything in there. So actually, and the box is fairly durable. It is really meant to be like, it's not like, say, the box of the Dungeon Tiles where that box is a play piece. Obviously, this isn't a play piece, but we did go for a nice sturdy cardboard stock with a nice finish, so you could use as a storage box for miniatures or your tiles or whatever you're bringing to the game. So
And DMs we'll be able to look forward to a similar treatment with the Monster Vault.
Yes. Yeah, we really see if we put pieces in a box, we want you to be able to use that box to store those pieces later on. There's also, as I mentioned, there's the two double-sided poster maps for use in the adventures. And there are, I believe, it's three sheets of tokens. Yep, there are three sheets of tokens. Now, two of the sheets are monsters with a couple pit traps, the 2x2 pit traps. And then the final token sheet is all different character tokens you could use, along with a few tokens for action points.
I want to look at all of them, so I'm going to pull the shrink wrap off.
Yeah, you can hear the shrink wrap tearing. So that's a shrink wrap package for the three sheets.
There are also action point tokens, so that people also can track how many action points they have. Ooh. Horses here.
Ooh.
Drake, giant spider, all sorts of creatures.
And it's also the tokens are numbered, so you can tell if you have, say, three goblins or three sturges. You can just put sturge 1, 2, and 3. The players can just, I'm attacking sturge number 2. I'm casting Charm from this place, Wrath, on sturge number 3. Things like that.
The thing I like about the player character sheet is they're the player characters' faces, and we have a huge array of men and women, characters of different races, so it'd be pretty easy for a group to find a token that is close enough for a given hero.
So now, one of the things that's changing in the DM side of the screen for Essentials is how magic items work. So you may have heard, we posted some articles about this, that magic items are now broken up into three different categories. Common, uncommon, and rare. The big difference between them is that common items, the characters can buy. Uncommon and rare, the characters have to find. And then within uncommon and rare, rare items are more powerful. You know, there's a funny thing in D&D where level kind of describes, it's easy to think of levels describing how powerful an item is. And while it does speak to that, the real use of level for magic item is to say, what level character is this item appropriate for? So if I'm playing a level 5 fighter and I have a level 9 item, you know that level 9 item is probably the most powerful item I have. So there's kind of a funny thing there where it's easy to think, well, a level 9 item should just be more powerful than a level 5 item. And that's kind of true, but it's, the real measure is just matching that level with the character level. So rarity does have some power attached to it. Well, not, it is power. A level 9 rare item is more powerful than a level 9 common item. This has more features, it's more useful. So there, you know, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy there to kind of wrap your head around. But the really important thing is just in terms of Dungeon Master control, and that rare and uncommon items, the DM adds to the game. The players can't just go out and buy those. Now, you can easily house rule it, or you can decide, instead of placing an uncommon item into a dungeon, just, you know, dropping it into an orc's chest, you know, treasure chest. I guess dropping it into the orc's chest would be the character's job with a weapon or something. But the, you know, you could say, in place of actually finding a level 9 uncommon or whatever, you meet a powerful wizard who will give you one of your choice. You could easily do that if you still want to give choice to your players. It's really a system we intend to be as flexible as the DM wants it to be. You know, you could easily just tell your players, in this campaign, it's a very low magic campaign. The only magic items are commons, and you can only find those. On the other hand, for a very high magic campaign, you could say, you can buy anything. You know, so everyone should have a bunch of rare items and doing all this crazy stuff. It's really giving power to the DM to decide how the campaign is going to work and how you want it to feel.
Yeah. I mean, because before, when all magic items were essentially on the same playing field, it was very difficult for the DM to control what kinds of items were getting into the campaign, other than going through every single magic item we've published and making a ruling on this item, that item, this other item. Now the DM can make a ruling on an entire category of items.
Yeah. So Shelley, as player in chief, what's your feeling on these new rules?
I think I'd rather have my choice of every magic item there is.
Well, you're player. Yes, exactly. Well, you're player in chief. That's what you should say.
I don't like looking for things. I just want to go buy them.
You just want to go buy them. You can still buy common items.
As with real life, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You just want to shop.
I just want to go shopping and buy whatever I want.
Shopping is fun.
Yes.
But that's why we still have common items. We wanted to have a piece of the magic item system that was still fully in the player's domain.
Yes.
And in a particular group, as Mike said before, a DM is at liberty to say items of every rarity are available for purchase and possibly available to be created, but we want our new default assumption to be just the common items are available for purchase and creation, and then uncommon items and and rare items are within the realm of the DM.
Right. Yeah, as usual. More power to the DM.
Well, and part of that is, speak up, Mike, if you feel differently, but I know in a lot of our early design meetings, one of the things we were trying to bring back into the game is the sense that magic items are the piece of the game where the DM has the ability to make slight tweaks in the party. Because pretty much every other aspect of a player character is the player's domain. You know, the powers the character has, the feats, the mundane equipment, the skill choices, etc., etc. Magic items are the one way for the DM to monitor how a group is performing over the course of a campaign and make slight tweaks to their capabilities through the magic items that he or she gives to the group.
Sure.
See, don't.
No, I do. I see the. I actually like the idea of unearthing treasure.
So that's basically the Dungeon Master's Kit in a nutshell. And it's probably the biggest change you'll notice there. And I think we talked about that in the rules compendium too. Does it talk about magic item rarity? Or
yeah,
is that...
magic okay. item rarity is mentioned in the rules compendium. I believe we even have a nod to it in Heroes of the Fallen Lands.
Yeah. And there are some items in the DM's kit, enough to get you started. It isn't as comprehensive as, say, a book just about magic items. But there are more items in there, so you can kind of take a peek at the direction that's going.
Also, because I'm sure some people listening to the podcast are wondering, our default answer to the question of what is the rarity of an item already in print, the answer is it is uncommon unless we tell you otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really just to really give DMs the option to say, okay, do I want this item in the game or not? Do I want my players to buy it or not? And we're through DDI, you know, offering more, especially common items to start with, to give players stuff to buy. And I'm sure as we go along, we will try to see some way about maybe updating some of those items to just label them as common. Really, commons are the one, I think, the most important at this point.
So say that you were a DM and maybe you had a question about dungeon mastering and wanted to maybe speak with somebody. What would you do in that situation?
That's a good question.
Yes.
What would you do, Jeremy?
You would call up our DM hotline.
Oh,
that
cool
was a great
is that?
Leading question. those listeners who don't know, we are going to be having our DM hotline again this year, as we did last year. It's going to be from October 20th to October 23rd, from 2 to 6 p.m. on each of those days, and that is Pacific Standard Time. The phone number you can call is 1-800-532-8455, and that's for North American callers only. And again, that number is 1-800-532-8455. But please don't call that number before October 20th.
We don't know where that number goes to right now.
we don't want to know.
We cannot be held responsible for who or what you end up talking to.
Also, if you called during those days, the people answering the calls, it will be a mix of members of our customer service staff, and also members of Dungeons & Dragons R&D. In fact, I will be one of the people answering the phone. Mike, will you be answering phones that day?
I might be. I'm not clear yet what my schedule looks
okay.
like. If they can work something out.
Yeah. But many of us who
yes.
work on D&D will
elite
be there
members.
Answering the phones.
And it was a lot of fun. I did it last year. It was a lot of fun. Don't be shy. Just give us a call. We're there waiting for calls. So
yeah, we love hearing from you.
And this year we started it, I think, a couple days early, or at least on a Wednesday, to make sure that those people who are in stores playing encounters could call as well, should anything come up.
Mid-game.
Yes, mid-game. Your players love that. When you stop mid-game and pull out your cell phone.
So, speaking of box sets, Gamworld is coming in October. So, Shelley, have you had a chance to play in Gamworld yet?
Oh, yes. I've played Gamworld, and I have to say, I am so excited about Gamworld. I think that it's the perfect game for me. It's a game in which I can pretty much be anything that I want to be. I know I can do that sort of in D&D, but even in D&D, there's parameters to what you can and can't be. I've always, well, I haven't, can't say always, but for about the past 5 years or so, I've had
a special affinity for Gamma World, the way I was first introduced to it. And if you've read my column, then you already know the story, and I'm sorry to repeat it. But here at Wizards, Halloween is a very, very, very big deal. And all of the departments try to come up with a theme, and they decorate accordingly, and everyone dresses up as part of the theme. Some departments are better than others. My department, sadly, we're not that good at coming up with our theme, and we never even place. But this one year, about 5 years ago, we thought we had it. We had a great idea, and we were going to decorate our department as Gamma World. And I was sort of embarrassed to admit at the time, like, I don't really know what this Gamma World is that they're all talking about, but everybody was really, really excited about it. And I think I even maybe like went to the wiki page to like find out more about Gamma World. Like, I knew it was something to do with D&D. I knew it was a setting, but I didn't know all the details about it. And I started reading about it, and I thought, oh my God, this is too cool. I love this thing. And we went to Goodwill. We went to the Salvation Army. We pulled trash out of our own dumpsters at home, came into work, and like spread dead leaves all over the department. We had this huge industrial fan that was just blowing everything around. We had garbage. We had broken down appliances. Everybody was dressed up in like these crazy costumes. The director of our department was pregnant at the time, and I mean, she was like 7 months pregnant, so she was very pregnant, and she had the shirt on with a baby doll head coming out of her belly. So, I mean, that's pretty creepy. And I was a raccoon, and I was wearing like these mechanic overalls or something. I had like little raccoon ears and a raccoon tail, and I was a raccoon. And later that day, I went to kickboxing class, and I had my face painted up like a raccoon with a little raccoon nose and little raccoon whiskers. And Bart Carroll was my partner, and that jerk face kicked me in the face so hard that he wiped my raccoon nose off. And it was like my little raccoon nose was actually on his big toe. What a jerk. Anyway, so that was Gamma World for me. And then when I later find out that we're actually re-releasing this game, I was so excited to actually get a chance to play it. The Wild Stallions, we as a group decided, let's, you know, forego our usual game, weekly game, and let's play Gamma World, because many of us hadn't ever played it before and we wanted a chance to learn how to do it. And I swear to God, the whole time I was thinking, well, we're doing this wrong, or whoever is running this game, Bart, doesn't know the rules because he's letting us do everything. And it was just the whole idea of how we were, our characters were created, which I love the whole random dice rolling, which we can get into a little later. But I ended up being a character that was a giant mind breaker. And according to Chris Youngs, that means that I was just a giant with an even bigger head. But my giant's name was Pinky Jones, and he was a giant teddy bear, because I learned that you're not just a giant. You don't have to think in the whole fee-fi-fo-fum realm. You can actually be a giant anything. Like, he was a giant teddy bear, and we fought some badgers and some evil pigs, and we did pretty well, actually. I think the Wild Stallions are actually quite good at Gamma World. And then I got to play in another game and created a whole new character, and I'll be writing about her next month. But her name is Mojita, and she was a gelatinous cockroach. And she has a lot of baggage. I should just leave it probably at that. But Mojita, she had quite a play experience. And I look forward to playing her again and creating many, many more Gamma World characters. And then this box, though, actually includes a lot of stuff, and anyone should just go into their game shop and actually pick up these box sets, which even the DM kit too, because these are heavy products.
They're stuffed, yeah.
They're really heavy.
Well, especially once Monster Vault comes out, that of all the box sets is the brick box set because of how many monster counters are
yes.
in there.
The Gamma World's no slouch. There's a lot of stuff in this box.
Yeah, I have the box right here. And it has the rule book for the game, which is a nice, slim trade paperback, just like the Essentials books.
Yep.
And the box set also comes with some battle maps, and then it also comes with tokens to represent the player characters in the game and their various enemies that they'll meet in this irradiated world. And the other thing that comes in the box is a deck of cards. And Well, it's actually, it's a single deck when you first get the box, but once you open it up, you see it's actually two different decks. There's the Omega Tech deck and the Alpha Mutations deck. And I know there's been a lot of talk online and at conventions about the cards in Gamma World and what their role is in the game. Mike, would you like to talk a little bit about what role the cards play?
Yeah, the cards essentially take the place of random mutation and random treasure tables in previous editions of Gamma World. So rather than rolling a table and writing something down on a piece of paper or the GM tracking it, you just basically draw a card from the deck. Now, one of the things they also did, and this ties a little bit into the background of the game and how it works, is that these mutations are very variable and they will come and go. So when you create your character, you roll on tables to determine what your basic mutations are, your themes, like we've talked about. Those give you a set of powers that you can just always have access to. And as you gain levels, you'll gain more access to more powers from those themes. The alpha mutations, though, are powers that exist on top of your other of your typical mutations. And these are a bit random. You gain one per encounter. And they tie into the background of this edition of Gamma World, where it ties more into, instead of just being a nuclear war and radiation messing everything up and, you know, different and other high-tech weapons, this one and the background of Gamma World here is a slight twist to it, that it is instead a sort of collapse of all these different possible realities on Earth. So you could have an Earth where dinosaurs never went extinct and instead survived the present day, another Earth where aliens invaded, and so there's all this high-tech stuff lying around. All that stuff gets compressed down into one Earth, and you know, we never really outline and say, here are the 10 realities that are there, but it just kind of gives the GM an excuse for all this weird stuff to happen. And that is why you have these alpha mutations that come and go, because essentially your character is undergoing these different changes to express different different versions of that character that existed in different realities. So as a default, you're generally drawing one card per encounter. You could just as easily, I mean, this is something when we talked about the magic item rules, where you have common, uncommon, and rare. Very easy to house rule. And I see this as actually a very similar way, where if you want to play a very wacky game, you know, a lot of comedy, a lot of just random stuff happening, you can be drawing a lot of cards. If, though, you say, you know what, I want to run a campaign of Gamma World, which is a little more serious, I could easily see you doing things where everyone just draws one card, you could just kind of screen out some of the wackier cards, that's your extra mutation, and then if you get exposed to radiation and survive, you could just draw another card to see how your character's changed. So these are mechanics that I really enjoy in role-playing games, because I think for the average player or beginning player, they can just run them as written and they just work. But if you're a more advanced player, if your DM likes to tinker, you can see some very easy ways to change the game in a very big way without, in the sense of rules, writing a lot of new rules. You know, like I said, a change is as simple as you draw one alpha mutation, and that's the alpha mutation you have for the entire campaign. That, to me, would be very, like, hardcore Gamma World experience. Or, you know, drawing three mutations, you know, for every encounter or every time, every round drawing a new one. You could do that.
Right.
It would, now your character would be a little more powerful because the alpha mutations tend to be, you know, some of them are very useful, some of them aren't so useful. But I don't think you would see the game collapse or fall apart or anything like that. I think the game would is fairly durable. You know, it would work out pretty well.
And one great thing about the cards is they can also be used as a DM tool.
Exactly.
If the DM is creating some wacky foe on the fly, the DM can draw an alpha mutation and just say, okay, this creature has this power.
Exactly.
That's cool. Yeah. But you should talk about that overcharge ability.
Oh, yeah. So the overcharge.
That was really fun.
Right. Oh, so I have you used the overcharge in your games?
Oh, yeah.
So the overcharge is basically with an alpha mutation. You can choose, when you use that mutation to overcharge it, you roll a d20. If you get a 10 or higher, you get some extra benefit. If you get lower than that, something bad happens to you. You may end up stunned. You may end up, I think there's one in here. I don't have the open deck. I'm just looking at them in front of me. But I think some of them, like, you know, the attack, if you have a robot, you try to command, it may turn and attack you or something like that. One thing to keep in mind with the cards is that there is a set deck that comes with the game. That's enough cards for you to play with. You can do an entire campaign with just those cards. We are also selling booster packs. And those are really meant to be, if you want to just create your own deck of cards to draw from, they're really just there just to add to the variety. I mean, just kind of think of it as if you had a big table of mutations you're rolling on. A booster pack lets you add 8 extra entries to those tables. You know, 4 for the tech table and 4 for the mutation table. Or you can just make your own table. Like the player just bought, you know, if you just bought 3 boosters and took the 12 mutation cards and shuffled them together without even looking at them. I mean, that's part of the fun of the game is you never really know what's going to happen next. So you could, I think, yeah, you could like collect cards and make a tuned deck, but I think that would kind of defeat the purpose of what's actually fun about this game, where you don't really know what's going to happen.
Yeah, when I've played it, I love that random element, not knowing what's coming up. You know, one of my favorite moments the last time I played is when I was playing my Hawkman, and he got one of these mutations, and suddenly he had clown feet.
Yeah.
And was wobbling around with his gigantic feet in the middle of a battle.
Mike, you guys should actually talk about your characters. And Mike told me that he's like, yeah, and Jeremy's playing this hawk guy. And I thought he said hot guy. I was like, no, Jeremy.
Maybe he was a hot, hawk guy.
Yeah, like he was saying like hot, like H-A-W-T.
Right. Hot.
Hot guy. Mike, you should talk about your character.
So I played my two origins. And I guess this shows you how, like, the game really is how you want to play. I had Giant and I had Seismic. And by the book, that would be I was like a giant rock guy. Or I could just be like this giant, super strong guy who like stomps his feet. Or even a robot or something. But I decided, no, that's lame. I'm going to be a giant baby. So I was essentially a...
Mike Merle is a giant baby.
A 12-foot-tall 2-year-old with a giant rattle instead of the Ostermeyer Wienermobile. Yeah, I had a giant rattle. And I really knocked the heck out of some pig guys, I forget what they're called.
And I find giant babies terrifying.
So absolutely.
Your character was very scary.
It was scary because I was playing him, like, imagine a 2-year-old with super strength who's 12 feet tall, who can do whatever he wants. That actually is pretty scary.
Yes.
Well, because it's like that scary baby in Toy Story 3.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Toy Story
3. Oh, okay. So. Yeah, that baby is totally creepy.
So if you want to learn more about Gamma World, or if you want to play Gamma World yourself, you should definitely check out the Gamma World Game Day, which is coming up October 23rd. Go to our website, to the store locator, and find a store near you.
Now it's time for our mailbag installment, and this week, rather than talking about rules, we're going to be talking about basically DMing and play style. And this goes along with our theme of talking about the Dungeon Master's Kit earlier. And so Adam wrote to us a while ago with a number of questions having to do with DMing. And particularly because Adam and his group of players are relatively new to Dungeons & Dragons. So I'll dive into Adam's questions. The first one is, when entering a new room or area, how much of the map should the DM reveal? It's most logical to reveal it according to lighting conditions and line of sight, but that can be cumbersome to keep track of. Revealing it all at once is faster, but then it's harder to surprise characters, or you risk monsters appearing in places that players may have thought they could see, like behind a pillar or around a corner.
That is an excellent question. That's a good question.
That's a good question. Do you have an answer, or are you just going to
praise
the question?
No, I want to know the answer.
You want to know the answer.
Yeah.
So generally what I do... I usually just show the players what they can see. If I'm drawing the map on, say, a piece of gaming paper or a battle mat or something, I'll just sort of know, okay, I have to add to it. If I'm using tiles, I'll just try to pick tiles where I can easily add them as we go. You know, if you have an 8x8 tile, but you know the players can only see half of it, I'll just use, like, a couple 4x4s. So it's really just a matter of planning ahead and just keeping in mind, you know, it's a little more awkward, but I think it's easier for the players to grasp what's happening. Now, the thing with tiles to keep in mind is you want to point out areas where there's a wall as opposed to, well, there's an empty space you just can't see into it. You know, if you just put a 4x4 tile down, well, you need to describe to the players where the walls are and where there's still space they can move through. But I think having that sense of, you know, exploration and discovery, I mean, really, before you put a monster down, you know, you might even consider, unless there's a monster there for them to fight, to not even put down a map yet, to just describe it verbally. And to get the players to interact with you purely verbally rather than moving miniatures around. And then if a monster jumps out of the shadows or something, as DM, just kind of keep a general idea of what the characters were. I mean, you don't need to be super exact. If you know, for example, the characters go into a library in the dungeon and are, you know, the wizard is looking through the books and the fighter's guarding the door. When the secret door behind the bookshelves opens and the ogre walks in, well, you know, okay, the ogre's going to be next to the wizard. You don't let the player who's playing the wizard just say, oh, no, I was outside the room. You know, it's,
right.
You know, but other than that, okay, if the fighter's in the door, out the door, it's not that big of a deal. you know, it's really only going to be as much of a deal as you make it, unless the player's getting, unless someone tries to be cheesy. So I'll usually just try to describe things, and then I don't draw them until I know a fight's going to start. And then I know exactly how much I have to draw and how much I have to show the players for things to be working. I'm not constantly building and taking apart things.
Yeah, when I'm DMing, it's very similar. Basically, when I say roll initiative to the players, that's also my cue to reveal the map. And my tip to beginning DMs about, you know, how much of the map to reveal, even in a battle, is, as you said, Mike, reveal how much the players, well, rather the characters can see.
Yeah.
But basically round up, because Adam, you know, makes the point, it could be cumbersome to actually figure out what is the line of sight of every player character. Yeah, that would be a total drag, and I do not recommend that any DM does that unless that's totally your thing. You're really into that tactical aspect of the game. So basically what I do is I reveal as much as the player characters can see, round it up. You know, basically as much as is convenient. Like if I usually use dungeon tiles for my encounters, if one of the player characters can see onto one of the tiles, then I put the whole tile down. That's what I mean by sort of rounding up.
Yeah,
that's, but if they can't see onto the next tile, then I don't put that tile down at all.
Like we just had an encounter on Tuesday with the players. It was a sort of, they're in a kobold lair. They went to a room. It was actually, they're in a hallway. They went to a room. It was like a small room, and there were two doors off of it, one of the doors was open. It was like a small kitchen area. And yeah, the kitchen area was big enough you really couldn't see all of it from where the players were. But I just went ahead and drew the entire room. Because it's just, you know what? What's really interesting isn't the size of that room, but what's in that room.
Right.
So while I may have drawn out the entire room and the players went around the corner to look into it, there may have been a couple kobolds there or a trap they just couldn't possibly see. You know, so it's like, sure, you can see that the kitchen, you can see into the kitchen, you can only see half of it. The second half you can't see. I've gone ahead and drawn that, but it's not that big of a deal. Because what's really interesting is what might be in there, not the size of the room. So
there's also the issue of where are the player characters standing when suddenly the action moves from a conversation between the players and the DM and a battle map.
Yeah.
And to address that, what I usually do is in an encounter area have what essentially amounts to a starting area for the player characters. And I let them have some flexibility where they place themselves in that area. But I have it be fairly confined so that they can't game you know, to an absurd degree where they are in relation to every single monster in the encounter.
So if you like they exactly. So if the players are walking into characters are walking into a room, they get ambushed, and say, well, put your you're somewhere within 10 feet of the doorway, either inside or outside. Okay, then you place your your miniatures, or if the thief is sneaking ahead to steal something when it happens. Well, okay, well, Bob, you're over here on this half of the room, everyone else is on the other half. Go ahead and just show me where you are.
For the rest of the mailbag, it's going to be just me and Shelley, since Mike
it should be.
Since Mike just got called out of our recording room into another meeting. So, Shelley.
Yes.
You have a question for me?
I do. Well, I have somebody's question for you.
Yes.
But I have also wondered this as well. Okay, so continuing on, here's a question. We weren't always sure how much information should be revealed and under which circumstances. Where can our DM get more guidance on what information to reveal and how to reveal it based on knowledge rolls? This is a good question because I've often wondered, number one, how does my DM know? Like, what? Like, really? That's all the information I'm getting on this roll? But also the few times that I've DM'd, I have no idea what they should know, and I just kind of... I probably err on the side of I don't give them enough information.
Well, the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Dungeon Master's Kit both give some advice on parsing out information to the players. But at the end of the day, it's really up to the DM. What feels comfortable, what feels like the right amount so that the players have the tools they need to make decisions, also that so that they have a sense of the world and of the story. But without giving away so much that there's no mystery at all.
It's a balance there.
Yeah. And it's going to be different for every group because some groups, they're playing a really heavy mystery game and the DM is going to be stingy probably about giving out the information. I guess I just coined a new term.
I think you did. I was just thinking
a stingy DM is a dingy.
I like it.
as for what information to give out connected to knowledge rolls, like an arcana check mm-hmm. or a history check or a religion check, that again, at the end of the day, is up to the DM. But I think a good rule of thumb is if the check has hit like an easy DC, and here I'm going to use our DC terms from the rules compendium, where we talk about easy DCs, moderate DCs, mm-hmm. and hard DCs. If you hit an easy DC, as a DM, I would probably give you information that is just a little bit more than the dude on the street would know.
Okay.
Like, when it's, as far as information goes that just dude on the street knows, I wouldn't even require a check. I'd just tell the players that information. So if you hit an easy DC, I'd say, okay, you know a bit more than that. If you hit a moderate DC, which is a DC aimed at someone who's trained in a particular skill, then I would probably fold in a little bit of specialized information. Something that you would have to have studied to know it. You would have to have gone on an adventure maybe to find out this particular piece of information. Now, if you hit a hard DC, then I'm most likely going to give you a very unusual detail, a little flourish that your character and a few other people know. Now, that also depends on how important the piece of information is. If it has no relation whatsoever to the story, the action,
right.
or it's not that funny or amusing in some way, or moving if it's a campaign that has a lot of drama, I'm probably not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. Does that help answer the question?
It does. It does. So one more question, Jeremy. What? Only, no, you know what? I'm sorry, but my friends do not answer questions like this at their jobs. Here you go. What are the rules or recommendations on looting corpses? Really?
This is one of the things we get to deal with working on Dungeons
and
Dragons.
Who talks about this stuff? Like, this is your job.
Exactly.
Like, well, what are the rules about looting corpses? Okay, wait. There's actually a little bit more to that question, but... I will be curious to hear this. Looting corpses, beyond the obvious items the DM has included for players to loot. So he goes on to say, since we're brand new characters with limited equipment, even the basic weapons the creatures we're attacking us with could be useful for our characters. Absolutely. Should my rogue be able to pick up and use the goblin sling without any issues? Could the warden equip the lizard man's shield? And he says that he has... basically gone with a general yes to weapons and no to armor if sizing would be an issue, which is logical and makes sense.
Sure.
Logical in the sense of we're actually answering a question about looting corpses.
Yes.
Okay.
So the answer I would give is our treasure system assumes a certain amount of abstraction in the game. Like our default assumptions for treasure are that adventurers are finding a lot of gold pieces mm-hmm. and other sort of liquid assets. And I would say that for the ease of play, it is best for most groups to assume that that money includes money that the characters are getting from actually selling stuff that they're finding. And just assume that without spending time at the table talking about stripping every corpse of the items that they could then sell back in town. Now, if that fits the style of a particular campaign, then a group should go for it. And that was fairly common in previous editions of the game. Often, you were going around at the end of a battle, slitting all of the goblins' throats, and then stripping off every single piece of equipment on them that was worth even a copper or two. But my recommendation would be to just assume that some of the gold that the characters are getting is coming from that kind of activity. Now, when it comes to actually picking up items that are useful, like
right.
an armor or weapon, that's totally the DM's call. Our guideline is that if a monster is described in its stat block as making magical attacks and it's doing so through a weapon, we do say that the magic is a part of the monster, and the monster might be channeling it through that weapon, but unless that weapon or implement is listed in the stat block as an actual magic item, a player character can't pick that weapon up and thereby inherit all of those magical abilities.
Okay.
But when it comes to just a mundane sling or a shield or a suit of armor that's appropriately sized. If the DM is comfortable saying that the player characters can pick that up, the DM should go for it. It's not going to unbalance the game. It's not going to mess with the treasure economy. But the DM is also perfectly free to just say that over the course of battle, all of that equipment is ruined, basically. You know, the monster's weapons are broken and can't be used, that their armor has been punctured as they've been slaughtered by the player characters.
That's so typical of a DM. Mean.
Yeah. So, again, that one really comes down to group style,
mm-hmm.
DM's choice. But at the end of the day, if people want a simple rule, I'd say it, just assume that's all going on in the background and is a part of the money that the player characters are getting.
Okay. That's good advice. I hope that our friend Adam will agree.
That's it for this installment of the official Dungeons & Dragons podcast. Thank you, Shelley, for joining us again.
Thank you.
Thank you to Mike, who is no longer in the room. we love hearing from our listeners, so please send us email at dndinsider@wizards.com. That N between the D and the D is an N, not an ampersand. And also please send us mailbag questions. If you have questions about the game's rules, if you have DM-style questions, we'd love to receive them, and we will get to as many of them as we can in the podcast. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep on gaming.